from the Media Factory in the south end of Burlington, Vermont. This is 99.3 FM, WBTV LP Burlington, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear a live interview with Vermont author Melanie Finn, whose new novel, The Hare, was a finalist for the 2021 New England Book Awards, and it actually won the 2021 Vermont Book Award for Fiction. The Hare's publisher is $2 Radio. Melanie Finn was born and raised in Kenya and the United States. She's the author of four novels, including The Gloaming, a New York Times notable book in 2016, and literary thriller, The Hare. Her work in a remote area of Tanzania as the writer and producer of Disney Nature's flamingo epic, The Crimson Wing, led her to found Natron Healthcare, a small NGO focused on bringing health education and sustainable health service to under-resourced rural communities in eastern Africa. She lives with her husband, twin daughters, and a wide range of domestic and wild animals on the side of a mountain in northern Vermont. The Hare tells the story of Rosie Monroe, of her resilience and personal transformation under the pin of the male gaze. Raised to be obedient by a stern grandmother in a blue-collar town in Massachusetts, Rosie accepts a scholarship to art school in New York City in the 1980s. One morning at a museum, she meets a worldly man, 20 years her senior, with access to the upper crust of New England society. Bennett is dashing, knows that polo refers only to ponies, teaches her which direction to spoon her soup, and tells of exotic escapades with Truman Capote and Hunter S. Thompson. Soon, Rosie is living with him on a swanky estate on Connecticut's Gold Coast, naively in sway to his moral ambivalence. A daughter, Miranda, is born just as his current con goes awry, forcing them to abscond in the middle of the night to the untamed wilderness of northern Vermont. Almost immediately, Bennett abandons them in an uninsulated cabin without a car or cash for weeks at a time, so he can tend a teaching job that may or may not exist at an elite college. Rosie is forced to care for her young daughter alone and to tackle the stubborn intricacies of the wood stove, snowshoe into town, hunt for wild game, and forage in the forest. As Rosie and Miranda's life gradually begins to normalize, Bennett's schemes turn malevolent, and Rosie must at last confront his twisted deceptions. Her actions have far-reaching and perilous consequences. So, after that very long introduction, I hope I still have Melanie Finn on the line. I'm looking forward to speaking with her. Melanie, are you there?
I hope I am.
Yes, you are. I hear you.
Yep.
Wonderful. Welcome to Write the Book, and I'm so glad to be speaking with you about The Hare.
Thank you for having me. Great to be here.
Yeah, and I should say Melanie is up in the wilds of northern Vermont, too, so hopefully we're going to have a good connection. So I wanted to say that when I read The Hare, I was perhaps most struck by your extraordinary understanding of your characters. And so I wanted to actually start talking about character, if that's okay with you.
That's great.
Obviously, you're very fond and protective of Rosie, or Rose, as she comes to be known. But your understanding of Bennett and your ability to show us who he is also just, it just blew me away. So I was wondering if we can start there. Early in the book, they're in a car on a dark road going, she thinks, to a party. And she sort of mentions little things like his BMW, his hands, which are strong and beautiful in her estimation, his manners, mostly, and his attention to her needs at times, right? So these are all sort of things that make you think, oh, this is a good guy. But then we have little clues about him, how he lies about his life. The car has a headlight out. The interior lights are also out. So there's something wrong here. He seems to steal a package from an empty house where the party was supposed to be, but there's no party. His attitude is terrible. He hates the countryside. He says nasty things about it. And he also ignores her obvious nausea. And he drives really fast. And he's drinking. So we quickly have clues that things are not all wonderful. So I thought it was so wonderful how you so quickly introduce us to these two characters and their nuances. And I wonder if you can just talk a little bit about designing these characters, Bennett and Rosie.
So for Rosie, I really had to go back to my own self when I was 18. And you're sort of on this, you have this terrible sense that you know everything and that you're very clever and that but in fact, you know, absolutely nothing. And I had to get into the headspace of a young woman who imagines that she's made this brilliant catch. And remembering my own really appalling, in some cases, just dangerous choices in men, but how I just really, I didn't have the experience to distinguish, you know, who was legitimate and who was just really like a rank person I should be nowhere near. And then with Bennett, I find Bennett actually a really complex character who doesn't get a lot of press and not really a lot of attention in the book. And I find him very tragic. He's obviously a man who has a lot of resources, both financial and intellectual. I mean, he's very smart, but life doesn't pan out for Bennett as he's expected it to. And so he doesn't really know what to do with that failure. And that failure sort of is what turns him into increasingly into a monster throughout the book.
Right. Yeah. And he's a very complex character. I like that you said that he doesn't get enough press or attention in the book. We do end up knowing more about Rosie and her background, a little bit about Bennett as time goes by. But he is, and it's interesting because so much of him is drawn on the page, and we don't have as much of his backstory. And there's this great scene where he's been detained. This wasn't a question I was actually going to ask you right now, but it's just coming to me while you've said this. He's been detained, and I'm not going to get into what's happened, but he's talking to her, and her daughter is with her, and they're behind, you know, there's glass between them or something like that. And he just tries to talk to his daughter, and there's just this childishness about him that in that moment just felt so, I don't know, it was very effective. I mean, I think his daughter loves him very much and will have these fond memories of him that aren't necessarily accurate. So that was like, I don't know, that was another great moment. And then there's this other important thing that happens in the car scene that I asked you about that I'm gonna move on to. But first, I just want to ask you, when you're establishing character, do you tend to enrich your characters as you go? Or do you kind of start with an initial idea that you already sort of know a lot about your characters as you begin?
Well, it's a combination of both. The character of Rose really came to me very strongly, which hasn't actually happened with my other books. I felt her very instinctively. And yet, even though I have some personal similarities with Rose's experience, I don't actually think I'm anything like Rose. Bennett was the one who really had to emerge and evolve. I really struggled with him initially because I didn't want to make him so unlikable that you would wonder why she was with him. The trick was to understand that attraction that she had for him and then the trap that she fell into with him. And I've actually had so many women come to me and say, oh yeah, I've had a Bennett. And so I think that he is perhaps an archetype, like often like a starter marriage. So he did emerge, whereas I think Rosie was much more fully formed. And then interestingly, Billy, who is, I think, one of my favorite characters I've ever written, started out as a man. As I started writing her as a man, I thought, I don't want Rosie to have another man in her life. I want her to experience another woman, to have a relationship with a woman, but a woman who is really different and unique and powerful in an unexpected way, mm-hmm. who would kind of be Rosie's teacher without being an obvious choice for that role. So I still remember the moment when I went, oh, wait, Billy is not a man.
Yeah, that's wonderful. And now that you've said that, it strikes me that you probably also had to differentiate Billy from her grandmother, from Rosie's grandmother, who was probably an older woman who was an influence in her life, but not a very nice one. And not one that she carries with her as time goes on in a tender way. So that was probably pretty challenging to kind of like create this very unique character that's older and a teacher. And yeah, I have another question about Billy later too, but that's great to know about.
Billy actually was based on a friend of mine who was a man in the Mojave Desert who had sort of been really a desert rat, lived in a filthy house and, you couldn't really tell the inside from the outside. But he had been incredibly accepting of where I was in my life and had just given me this sanctuary. And I've always been grateful to that. You know, I think for any person who's struggling with what life is throwing them, to have that refuge of a person who just accepts you and requires nothing of you is, I think it can really, I'm not saying in my case it's the difference between life and death, but at the time maybe it does feel that dramatic.
Yeah, yeah. I want to talk a little bit about, we're still on character, but about the details that will add to characters, right? And I think one of the things you do so well, which is why your characters are so rich, is that you find these details that are just perfect. So when it comes to Rosie, we see she is willing to accept who Bennett is at this point, at the early point of the book, because she's so impressed by him. She's also a little frightened of him. For example, he doesn't like people who chew gum, but she's feeling nauseated, as I said. So she like sneaks a piece of gum into her mouth furtively. That was such a great detail because now we know a little bit more about who she is, more about who he is. So do you get really excited when you find the right detail to convey what it is you're trying to do? Do they come to you easily? Do you keep a journal full of ideas and go back to it? How do you mine for details?
I wish I could be as organized as keeping a journal. I think what unfortunately happens is that I start keeping a journal and then I misplace it. And so I start another journal and then I misplace that. And then I just write things on envelopes. So that just hasn't worked for me. It really is in the present. I'm a working mom, so I have tons of stuff going on. So when I write, I have very short periods of concentrated time. And, it's almost like, I have to focus in so intensely in that time. It's like going into some sort of, CAT scan at the hospital. You're just in this tube and you can kind of hear the outside world going around you. And the focus in that time is very intense. And I do find that the characters emerge in those moments. So those moments when I'm really writing and then like random moments when I can't fall asleep at night or I'm out for a run when I'm really not thinking and my mind is sort of off in a loose way.
Right.
Sometimes those are just as important as those highly, highly, highly intensely focused periods as well.
Yeah. I once read an article about why that happens and that your brain really is working when you don't think it is, but it's like a part of your brain that it's like, why does it happen when you're in the car? Why does it happen when you're in the shower? And there's a real reason for that, but I'm not going to be able to remember to tell you what it is.
I'm the big believer in the nap. Like if you are writing and you're stuck and you really just can't figure it out, just take a nap. You don't actually have to fall asleep, but just the act of lying down, letting go, it's amazing. Like stuff comes. And besides, if the door is shut, no one can actually see that you're lying down with your eyes closed. They think you're still working. So it kind of works both ways. But I have found that is, if all else fails, just lie down and take a nap. I have a day bed in my office.
Oh, that's great. So there's this other event that happens in that car ride. I am actually going to talk about the rest of the book eventually. But this event felt so important to me. I kind of thought this was going to be a pivotal moment that we would pursue for the rest of the book, and it didn't turn out to be. But on that same drive, at the beginning of the book, they run over something in the road that feels suspiciously like some kind of living thing, a lump that's almost large enough maybe to be a rolled-up carpet, and that's what she thinks. That's what she tells herself when she doesn't want to think about what else it might have been. She's not sure, and he does not stop. And when she asks him to stop. He says no, and she doesn't insist because she's just so, because she's got that furtive gum in her mouth. You know, it's the same thing. She's intimidated by him. I felt like this really was a very important moment early in the book, and it kind of like worked to establish all of the kind of darkness and lies and the subtext of violence around Bennett. But I wasn't sure what would happen with that moment. So I just wonder if you can speak to that moment and what it meant to you for them as you wrote it.
That event, actually, it did happen to somebody who I knew, and almost exactly in that way. She was young, oh, wow. And she was in thrall with this older guy, and they ran over something in the night, and then in the morning he went to the car wash, and she never said anything. And I've always been so struck by that she never said anything. Mm-hmm. And it goes to the heart, I think, of the silence that women take upon themselves when they are either the victims of or the participants in these awful acts, whether they're sexual or, in this case, you know, illegal, that we tend to be quiet because we don't want to make a fuss. Mm-hmm. It really spoke to me about Rosie's lack of power. What could she actually do? She could go to the police, but how could she, like, how, when she later, a few chapters later, she actually considers going to the police. And she realizes that that's just not an option. And Bennett also quickly dissuades her from that. So you see how she's already trapped in this relationship, not just trapped by him, but trapped by her own deep sense of obligation to this man, or to any man, or to anyone with power.
Right, right. And it's also the 1980s. So it's not like she could go on Google the next day and say, you know, did anything turn up on that road last night, you know, and do any research. So characters go through change in narrative, as we all know, and Rosie and Bennett go through their changes. I'm not going to give away things about the end, but I will say that Rosie becomes Rose, and Rose is much more confident than Rosie was, and kind of a more fierce person, a person who comes to better understand her situation. Did you know who she would become and who he would become as you started?
I was less sure about how far Bennett would go. Mm. I felt instinctively that he was capable of great violence, and that he would put her in real threat, and that would be the pivot point for her. But I wasn't sure quite how that would come about. For her, I started writing the book right when the Trump presidency started, and which also coincided with my entering menopause. Mm. So I had this, I guess, tremendous anger, but it was also a tremendous energy that I was angry because of the things that Trump said about women in a way that was just either laughed off or not taken seriously. And regardless of your political leanings, I don't think it's appropriate for the presidential candidate or the president of this country to make derogative comments about women or people of color or, you know, people who have mental disabilities. And here was this person who was just getting away with that. It seemed to me the ultimate privilege of the patriarchy. And then, you know, the bit about menopause, just realizing, as Rose does, that this is a different time in your life, that you do actually get to close the door on something. And in closing that door, open another one and step through that. And how do you want to live that last part of your life? The part of your life that isn't attached to being sexual or attractive in the way that it was for that first part of your life. And I wanted very much to explore that through her, and for her to find a legitimate liberation by the end of the book, which I think she does.
Yeah, that was really interesting too, because I think that we are used to books where the beauty of a character, a female character often, the beauty is not a changing thing and is not described to be a changing thing. And so that was interesting to me that she looks very different from the beginning of the book to the end. And it was a relief because that's very real. It's what happens, you know. So that was good. I wanted to ask you this question. You write a lot about wealth because Bennett teaches her a lot about the subtleties of wealth, the difference between a scarf and a cravat, the fact that Polo is about ponies, the way to spoon your soup, as I said in the intro. But then you also tackle poverty, extreme poverty. I mean, Rosie has some really difficult times. And I just wondered, as an author, did you feel like two different people going from the scenes in Connecticut to the scenes in Vermont? And did you kind of have to approach the work differently as you were writing about these two different worlds?
I'm not quite sure that I felt myself split. In my life, I've had the experience of being around unbelievably rich people. I mean, you know, the kind of succession wealth where people say, oh, let's go for a picnic. And what a picnic means is loading up 4 helicopters, mm-hmm. With one advanced helicopter, you know, taking the chef and all the champagne and the lobsters. So seeing that wealth and being around that wealth, it's certainly not mine, but I've experienced it. And then being myself struggling, as most writers have financially, where you just have really no idea, you know, you are looking at the discount beans and the day-old bread, but also seeing the kind of poverty that is certainly endemic here in the Northeast Kingdom. And when I lived in the Mojave Desert, how people struggled financially there. And it seems to me that this is a very schizophrenic country. Mm-hmm. And the schizophrenia, as I write about, is within the people who are poor and the people who are rich as well. You know, people who are poor don't necessarily resent people who are rich. They resent more people who are maybe middle class or one step up the financial ladder from them. So it was really interesting to kind of layer that in as part of Rosie's own disempowerment, because of course poor people don't have choices,
right?
They don't have options, they have ultimatums. And that's really, you know, what has kept Rosie trapped for so long, is that she just cannot get a leg up. She cannot find a way out of the poverty trap. And I think that is the case for an extraordinary number of people who we look at objectively and say, well, why don't they just do this or do that? And if you begin to look closer, you think, well, because they just simply can't afford it. And they don't have choices.
I think if you're not in the habit of having opportunities presented to you, then taking risks is riskier too. Like if an opportunity were to arise, would she take it? Like, would she feel comfortable to take it? Would she recognize that it was there for her? Do you know what I mean?
I do. And I'm also curious to know, you know, what opportunities present themselves. I'm here now actually in the library of the Northern Vermont University, which is a very important community college for the Northeast Kingdom. And as we all know, you know, it was slated to close 2 years ago. And I wonder, well, if you close this community college, what choices are you giving people who live in this area, mm-hmm. to get a higher education? Mm-hmm. You know, people, young women who maybe already have a child, well, they can't drive all the way to Chittenden County. They can't drive all the way to wherever else there's a community college. So I think that we think about taking risks. I'm not even sure that the people who are really living as Rosie did could even consider it. Like, the risk wouldn't even come along. It wouldn't,
right.
be like, if you just take a risk, you can do this. There's literally just going from day to day and bill to bill and, you know, trying to keep the heat on.
Right, right. And unlike Bennett, she's a scrupulous and honest person. So it's not like she's going to take advantage of anyone else in order to give herself a leg up either.
Well, just to be a total socialist here, I mean, I think that's a statement too. the enormous wealth in this country that is gotten either ill-begotten gains or, you know, creamed off the top of the hard work of people who are scrupulously underpaid.
Right, right.
So, sorry.
No, don't apologize. No, I. It's funny too because we have to talk in code a little bit because people haven't read the book and I don't want to give anything away. But I know what you're talking about, and yes, that's true too. So I loved. So we were talking before about how Bennett is a complex character, and we're talking now about the wealth. And the scenes in the beach club, to me, were very interesting. Like, the beach club conveyed the way that rules and snobbery sort of set a tone. And Rosie is made to feel very small in the club. But later there's this almost kind of weird relief when Bennett brings her back and goes up against that place. Sort of, you kind of almost feel like he's vindicating her a little bit. But then ultimately, he's serving himself. And so moments like this really, I just liked them. I felt hopeful that he was going to be somebody I liked, and then I felt betrayed by him. And it happened over and over, and it was just so nicely predictable. I don't think I have a question. I just was also going to mention that moment. So
I think that's the sort of the difficulty of men like Bennett is that they always give you enough that you feel special and you feel loved and you feel protected, and so you discount all the rubbishy sides, right, that, you know, often, which are just, you know, like flags, like madly semaphoring in the background. But, you know, because you're just needy enough or just damaged enough, you ignore that. And the scene in the country club, I would be surprised if there's a person out there who hasn't had that moment when you just feel, you know, you're dressed wrong.
Yep.
You know that your shoes are wrong, and you feel utterly belittled. You feel humiliated. It's a physical sensation, and you just can't wash it off. It's utterly devastating when it happens. Luckily, you know, that's the other thing. When you get older, it doesn't happen anymore. It's just like, yeah, okay,
right,
whatever.
Right. let's see. We talked a little bit about how we learn about each of their backgrounds a little bit or a lot. But Rose's history has some damage in it, some abuse that is very painful for her, very painful memories about a lodger that her grandmother used to rent out rooms. She took in lodgers to make a living. And one of these lodgers, Rose remembers as the giggle man, and he would touch her inappropriately, tickle her until she giggled, which leaves her with shame in addition to painful memories, but shame also about laughing, I think, and anger and all this stuff. I just wondered, like, can you talk about this aspect of her personal history and how filling out a character's backstory to add energy to who they are on the page is important?
Well, I had been sexually abused as a child, and for a long time I had wanted to write about it, mm-hmm. but I couldn't find the way in without just sort of sensing, oh, this is just going to be too slippery of a slope. As a writer, you really need an objectivity. You need that kind of bird's eye view. And I just felt too close to what had happened. And mm-hmm. but then when I hit menopause, again, it was that thing. All of a sudden, I could look back and I could assess how that formative experience had contaminated so much of my life, and so many of my choices had been tied to those 2 or 3 years when the abuse had happened. And so I wanted, with Rosie, to just be able to see, if you take someone who's abused like that, again, we talk about this idea of choice or free will, well, how much of that actually exists for people who are damaged? and you know, our expectations that people, they forgive, or they go get therapy. I think that we're underestimating the very insidious nature of any kind of abuse and how long it takes to work your way free of it. So for Rosie, that abuse was my abuse, and although mine was much more specifically sexual, I also did remember another time when this man tickled me and he wouldn't stop, and he kept tickling me and tickling me and tickling me until I vomited.
Oh God.
And then he let me go. And I, you know, it's like you think about what kind of a person does that to a child, who knows that person is laughing, but they're also screaming to stop and you don't. And the violation of that child's body in a way that you can say, I was just tickling. Right. But of course you're not just tickling, you're violating that body. There was something so sly about the giggle man doing that mm-hmm. that he could never be caught. You know, mm-hmm. he could always just say, we were just having fun. Because of course, all you would hear is her laughter. And that seemed to me just the worst kind of man, the worst kind of abuse, because he could never be found out. He could never be nailed for it. And she would always have that mark on her. Well, you laughed. You were clearly right. Enjoying it.
Right. She's involuntarily made to be a co-conspirator sort of thing.
Exactly. Which is the hallmark of a lot of sexual abuse. Mm. You know, you kind of, the abuser kind of pulls you into that as if you're some sort of equal partner in this relationship. So that was really the whole where I was circling around with the giggle man.
Yeah. Okay. We already talked a little bit about Billy. I want to just talk a little bit more. There are two characters in the book that have some sexual ambiguity or trans characteristics. Billy, or Wilhelmina, is a character who Rose first thinks is a man, and it sounds now we learn that the character was a man when you started writing. But Rose eventually comes to realize that her neighbor Billy is a woman. And then there's a character named Christiane, who was a boy that Rosie knew in school and dated a little bit, who has transitioned to a woman when they meet for dinner later in the story. So as we said, Billy becomes her teacher and close friend. Christiane presents a kind of quandary for Rose as she kind of struggles to make sense of them both identifying as women despite their very different life experiences. Those were really interesting, each of them, and I wondered how it was to write those characters, and I wondered if it was at all a little scary to write those characters. It's hard to write about certain people, you know, and be fair to them, and also maybe, you know, convey something that isn't what's politically correct. So I just want to know how it was for you to write these things.
So there's definitely two spoiler alerts in this. So for Billy, I had always thought of Billy as someone who had just simply set aside her sexuality. And a woman, a gay friend of mine read it, and she actually was quite upset. She said, I don't like the fact that, you know, Billy's attracted to this pretty young girl, Rosie. And I hadn't intended that at all. I hadn't intended that Billy's desire for Rosie was a sexual one. I had intended it to be a kind of like a platonic, like that Billy finally had found a family and
yes.
someone she could protect and someone she could share a life with. And again, you know, you write things in the way that you intend, but you put the book out in the world and people interpret it in a different way. And, you know, that's just how it is with books.
Right.
With Christiane, I had actually had a friend who transitioned to become a woman. And my reaction was very much like Rose's. I was deeply confused by this. I couldn't get my head around it. And I felt upset and angry for the reasons that Rose does. Like, why would you, you know, you've reaped all the benefits of being a man all your life, and now you want to become a woman. And the attributes that this friend of mine had chosen seemed to me caricature of a woman, you know, big breasts and high heels and lots of makeup. And I just looked at her and I couldn't grasp how that was what she thought a woman was, because of course, entering menopause, I was trying to renegotiate my own understanding of mm-hmm. what it meant to be a woman. And so I had to go through this whole process of discussing this with my friend very openly, but also with another neighbor who was very helpful. And basically, in the end, she said, first of all, this is none of your business. Like, mm-hmm. if people in midlife decide that this is who they are and they follow that path, then you need to just respect that, because most of the time, and certainly in the case of my friend who did transition, she felt enormous relief. And she also had to find who she wanted to be as a woman. So her, you know, having big breasts and wearing short skirts and high heels was in a way her own exploration of womanhood, which has taken me, you know, 57 years. And this person, you know, was basically having to do it in 2 years. And so it was enormously, I can't even think of the word, because the word interesting is too objective and scientific.
Right.
I was so appreciative of this friend's journey and the courage that it took her to come to the conclusion that she did and then to follow through with it. But that said, I also realized that she was able to fulfill this idea of who she was because she had a lot of money. So it came back again to that idea of class and ultimatums and choices and options. So, and then the whole trans thing, it has been, there was a, I went onto Goodreads and there was a whole, you know, string of like, this book is anti-trans and should never have been published. And I was reading this going, well, if we follow these guidelines that if you have a character who is confused and working through that confusion, trying to actually have empathy and come to understanding, and that is called transphobic, I don't know what we're supposed to write about. Mm-hmm. You know, books are about conflict, and they're about people trying to figure out how to be better,
right,
how to do the right thing. And that is exactly what Rose does. And Christiane is actually a wonderful patient guide to her, as my friend, you know, was to me. So it was sort of odd to be accused of that abuse when that was not at all in either of the characters, and it wasn't at all in the intention.
Did you respond? I'm just curious, did you respond on Goodreads, or did you just let it go?
I did, actually. I had been reading Maggie Nelson's wonderful book, Four Songs of Freedom, in which she talks about that very problem of writers and artists, you know, being accused of being abusive. And she was very eloquent in which she said, you know, you can't stifle yourself because you're afraid that you're going to upset someone when what you're saying is not upsetting in itself. Like, I was not writing, you know, nasty, vitriolic, horrible things about people who become trans. I was writing about the experience of a straight person trying to understand someone who is trans, mm-hmm. and how that comes about and what that means to her. So the other thing I really feel like is, you know, we would never have had one of the best books of all time, which is Lolita, if we are going to confuse a writer's voice and a writer's choice of characters and characters' motives with the point of view and the beliefs of the writer, him or herself or themself, right? You know, books exist for us to explore ideas that are not our own. And if we can't accept that, then we shouldn't read books.
That's
have
great.
I dug a big hole for myself?
No. I mean, I find it to be a very interesting question because I feel like people get in trouble for things that they didn't get in trouble with before. And I don't see it as entirely a negative thing because I think it makes us think a little bit more about what we write and what we say and how we present our ideas to the world. But I worry that we won't present our ideas at all if we are too afraid to annoy the listening audience or whatever. So that's why I asked the question. I thought that was a great answer.
I think it's really true. I just went to see Spamalot this weekend, which is hilariously funny. But in the middle of the third act, there's this song. I think it's basically like, in order to have a Broadway show, you must have a Jew. And it's this whole song. And the audience went quiet. And I myself was quiet. And I thought, oh, I don't know what to think anymore. I don't know if this is funny. I don't know if this is satire. Did a Jewish person write this? Are there Jewish people in the audience? Like, the whole thing was very confusing. And as you said, I think it's great that we have these conversations and that this discomfort comes into our lives.
Right.
And we really have to examine it. Because for a long time, you know, there was no discussion. There was one point of view. And now we have to listen to other people and we have to have other perspectives. And, you know, at the end of the day, I'm still ambivalent about that song in the middle of Monty Python, even though, of course, the whole point of Monty Python is it makes fun of everybody and it's irreverent.
Right.
But I'm still out there, you know, like if anybody wants to talk about that song, I'm really ready to hear because I'm still confused.
My husband plays piano and just for himself, and you know he likes to sometimes play songs that he can sing to. And he started playing all this Tom Lehrer stuff, and I'm like, I'm not sure that's allowed. I don't think we can do that anymore. I don't know if you know Tom Lehrer's stuff, but
I don't.
Very,
I
very, very irreverent. Yeah.
We have to question, but then again, I think we have to be careful that we don't become so precious and so humorless. And then again, you know, I'm a white educated woman,
right.
So I already have like a huge amount of privilege to turn around and say, oh, you know, well, you know, just have a sense of humor about it. It's tricky.
It's complicated.
It's not getting any easier.
It's complicated. And it's, it makes for good conversation. Okay, so Melanie, I always ask my guests what they've been reading lately that they might like to recommend to listeners. Have you read any books lately that you would say, oh, this is a great one?
I have. I'm actually reading two great books, both of which are fairly English. So the first one is On the Black Hill by Bruce Chatwin, which is a very old book. And Bruce Chatwin was, I think, he was my first literary hero. And I sort of discovered him in the late 1980s, just right before he died. I think he died in about 1989. Mm-hmm. But I just became a huge fan of his very eclectic storytelling. You know, he would write On the Black Hill is about two twin brothers who live on a farm in Wales. But his other book, you know, The Viceroy of Ouidah, is about a slave trader in West Africa. And then the other book that he'd written that I love, Songlines, takes place in the Australian desert. So he's just a very, very clear writer, very concise and lean and beautiful at drawing characters in very few words. And then the other book, and I can't for the life of me remember the author's name. It's an English book called something about empire, and it's a look at how absolutely awful the British Empire really was. And since I am a colonial child myself, and the product of civil servants who went out to serve empire and a great empire-building diaspora, it was fascinating to just read this. You know, we're talking about other perspectives. to read this other perspective of history. And I, coming back to that idea of Christiane and what we were talking about earlier, I think that this is the beauty of where we are now in both history and literature, is that these other points of view that have been excluded and sidelined come to the fore, and some of them are exquisitely eloquent and on the mark, and some of them are just messy and angry shouts of agony and sort of disbarment from society. So I really enjoyed the book, and I'm sorry that I cannot remember the name of it.
Well, that's fine. We'll figure it out, and I'll put it on the podcast site, so we'll be able to share that.
Perfect.
What are you writing now, or are you not yet writing something new?
Well, I am actually working with my husband, who is a wildlife filmmaker and also an insane birder. I think that's like an oxymoron. All birders are insane. So I call them insane birders. It's like,
so it's redundant? Like, is that what you're saying?
Yeah, it's redundant. Like pink fuchsia, right? So he's a mad birder. We're working on a new film together called Birds of America, How Birds Save Us. And so that's a really exciting project and very much geared to trying to reach a wide audience and have a big influence, not just on how people see birds, but how people see the landscape around them, as we are now in the middle of Nomo May, in case anybody out there doesn't know about Nomo May. And then I am working on a new book, but it's been incredibly difficult to find those corners of time. So hopefully this summer will bring that time for me, because I do miss it. I started it. The characters are with me, and I miss them every day.
You wrote The Hare in 2021, and then you won the Vermont Book Award. Has that extended your book tour and created a new amount of energy around publicizing the book?
I suppose it could. To be completely honest, I have not put any energy in that direction, simply because I've got so many other things that I'm sort of moving on with.
Right.
And I think I put a tremendous amount into pushing the book when it first came out, when we were all in COVID lockdowns. So you couldn't go anywhere. You couldn't do anything. And I ended up calling, I think it was like 300 independent bookstores that carried The Hare, that I knew carried the book. And having all these amazing conversations with all these incredible independent bookstore owners, some of whom were like, oh, Melanie Finn, we love your book. We love your work. And then others who were sort of, who? What? We don't carry any self-published works here. And then you're in this horrible position saying, no, it's not self-published. It's real, it's a published, by a publisher. So no, I haven't. I'm grateful for this. I think it's one of those books that does seem to have legs.
Yeah.
I think because of the messaging within it. And I just encourage, people to reach out. I have a website. I love getting readers' responses. I think just being able to connect with people who've read the work and either liked it or even not liked it, hated it, is also just a really wonderful part of being a writer.
Great. I just have like one more question here. I want to talk about the title, The Hare. Did you title the book, or did you have an editor that suggested the title, or how did that go?
Well, originally the book was called The Giggle Man. And when I handed it to Eric Obanoff, who's my editor and the publisher at $2 Radio, who is just, they are the most amazing publishers, just putting that out there. Eric felt very strongly that we should not name the book after the abuser, after the perpetrator. And I thought that's why I'm with Eric as a publisher, because that's exactly the kind of unbelievably sensitive and insightful comment that he would make. And he actually came up with The Hare. I think because there's a couple of scenes in which the hare is referenced.
And the hare ends up being this incredible not specifically named, but in my mind, very obvious metaphor for, you know, the unempowered, vulnerable individual.
Exactly. A hare is a prey animal.
Right.
And a hare lives by the code of being a prey animal. And yet, even prey animals eventually, as in Rose's case, find that they have ways to escape.
Right. Okay. Wonderful. So I always offer a writing prompt to listeners who are writers. And I wondered if you, a lot of times my guests will suggest something, a prompt or an exercise or an activity to get their writing started in the coming week. I wonder if you have anything like that.
I think it's always great, as I said, apart from taking a nap, to start outside the box with Rosie. Something, funnily enough, no one really brings up is her sense of smell. She's really aware of how things smell. And I think that when you're thinking about characters, to think about all their senses and just be aware that it's not just what you see or what you hear, but really trying to imagine how a character even feels the sensation of silk or wet grass, but also all the other senses, the senses of smell. How does that come through to the character? Because I think sometimes we get caught up with those very obvious senses. Does that sound
yes.
like a
yeah. writing? That's wonderful. Thank you very much. That's great. All right. Well, I want to mention again, I've been speaking with Melanie Finn, who is the author of The Hare, which won the Vermont Book Award and was published by $2 Radio. Melanie, this has been great. I really enjoyed speaking with you.
Shayla, thank you for having me, and thanks for putting up with some of the totally anticipated technical difficulties of trying to communicate here in the Northeast Kingdom with its one cell tower. So, and complete lack of broadband. So, thank you, Shayla.
From the Media Factory in the south end of Burlington, Vermont, this is 99.3 FM WBTV LP Burlington, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. That was an interview, as I said, with Melanie Finn, and her book is The Hare, published by $2 Radio. It's the winner of the 2021 Vermont Book Award for Fiction. You can learn more about her at melaniefinn.com. And you heard the Write the Book prompt. I will post it again on the podcast site. It has to do with the senses and the sense of smell and thinking outside the box. I would love your feedback about the show. Let me know if you'd like me to interview certain authors or if you have events to announce. Be sure to tell your friends about Write the Book and about the podcast site, writethebook.podbean.com, where you can get all the archived episodes. New and recent episodes of Write the Book are available wherever you get your podcasts. Just subscribe to have them sent to your podcast app. A reminder to listeners who write, I do share a writing prompt each week, so be sure to check the archives of Write the Book if you'd like to find any that you might have missed. Today's was more of a publishing prompt, but sometimes we have to do that too. You can also access the podcast and link to our social media presence at my own website, shelaughswithoutus.com. If you like the show, please rate it where you find it, like it on social media, talk about it with your friends. Up next at 5, stay tuned for Feminist Frenzy, the radio show with a feminist agenda. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro, and you've been listening to Write the Book. This is 99.3 FM, WBTV LP, Burlington, Vermont, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. Stay well and have a great week.